Welcome to Twitch of the Death Nerve, a cult movie podcast that takes a deep dive on a different topic each episode. Our wide-ranging discussions will touch on genre, culture, and the history of psychotronic cinema. I'm Charles.
I'm Sam.
And on this little rinky-dink movie podcast, Sam and I, we rarely engage with the current cultural moment, the zeitgeist, the spiritual machinations undergirding the never-ending blood drive of popular culture. We aren't discussing the Oscar winners from last month. We don't do an erotic thriller episode when everyone's talking Love Lies Bleeding. And we aren't discussing Black Emmanuel just because a fancy box set just came out. This is not because we are above it in any way. Gosh, it's not at all. I am 100% locked in a death waltz with the cultural conversation of the day. Just not publicly. It's perhaps because of Sam's academic background in film history and my permanent fear of falling prey to the siren call of every shiny new object that passes by my fingertips that it keeps us on a different track. But friends, fear is the mind killer, and I've been worm-pilled. I see things clearly. I've sipped the water of life and supped the spice melange. I feel the cold stirrings of jihad in my bones, and I now walk the golden path. I've been worm-pilled. Cue the Hans Zimmer. We're talking Arrakis, Dune, Desert Planet. And joining us on the program, making his Death Nerve debut, is the guy who invented the movie podcast as we know it, Mr. Mike White of the Projection Booth. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate being here.
Of course, of course. I mean, I'm sure all of our listeners are familiar with your work. I know when we first started talking about doing Death Nerve, I was really anxious because I never podcasted before, so I asked Sam and John, our old co-host, for advice, and both of them, separate from one another, mind you, each told me I needed to listen to the Projection Booth. Mike, I've been cribbing your notes for years. Your podcast is the absolute gold standard, and I can't tell you how thrilled I am to have you here to talk Dune.
Was that like, don't do what this guy does?
When... No, not at all. Not one bit.
Don't say anything political. Don't talk about movies that are too obscure. Yeah, yeah. I don't think followed either of those lessons at all.
All right. I kind of want to start off by almost arguing with my initial point about kind of making a deliberate effort not to engage with the standard movie-centered conversation of the day, and the implication that Dune is some shiny new cultural object, it's not. Dune has been part of our collective spirit since the moment it was published in the early 1960s. It has never not been relevant. I assume, have both of you read the books, and how do you feel about Dune, Frank Herbert, and its legacy?
I read the first book. I just re-listened to the book because I listen to a lot of audiobooks now on the way back and forth to work. And I think I made it about halfway through the second, but that one was tough. It was tough for me to get through the second book, and people say it's easy because it's the shortest, but I do like the first book quite a bit. I've just never gone on from there, and I've always felt like I need a Sherpa to make sure that I'm reading them in the right order, that I'm staying away from bad books if there are such things, Maybe like the Brian Herbert books, but yeah, I've been intimidated, and that second book didn't do a whole lot for me to not be intimidated. When Paul loses his eyesight and he's seeing things through like future vision and stuff, I was like, that's kind of a cool idea. But at the same time, it was a lot.
Yeah, that one. So I've read the first couple of books, not all of them. I actually love the second book, but it is, I think, the most challenging of the first three. But my problem, as Charles knows, is it's like every couple years I tell myself I'm going to read the complete series, including some of the Brian Herbert co-written ones. But it's like, I just read the first one, I read the second one, and I love them so much that I'm like, oh, maybe I should just start again with the first one.
Yeah.
Dude, it's a perfect book.
I know that feeling. And I also understand that's a lot of people have that criticism of the second book, and kind of each of the sequels, they kind of have that criticism to them. And I may be wrong, but I think I kind of know why. I've read the first four, the last one being God Emperor of Dune that I read. And I think it's because, I mean, Frank Herbert, he's doing something very kind of special and unique with the Dune series. He's engaged with this sort of mind-expanding dialectic with himself. I mean, the original Dune, it builds to this perfect thesis. And each successive book completely destroys what the last one had built. And but I think that kind of, it creates this antithesis, this antithesis. And then by God Emperor, there is this, like, you know, perfect dialectical synthesis being made. And, but it's hard to see everything that the last one sort of stood for being torn apart, you know? And I don't know. I think that the Dune series, it's ultimately about becoming God in order to redistribute power away from the extractive industries and the elite families and spread that power over a mass of people who then use their collective wills and their shared generational experiences to overthrow and kill God themselves. It's like a deeply philosophical and intense series that is really hard to digest, and I think it's even harder to adapt in any ways.
And hard to explain. Mm-hmm. I feel like the way that I came to the book is, growing up, I read a lot of fantasy and sci-fi because that's what my dad was really into. And so it's I think, helpful when you have somebody suggesting things in a genre that is just so vast. But I think what makes Dune so special and so different, and Charles, I know you've read a lot of sci-fi, so correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like there aren't really that many sci-fi authors from the 60s or fantasy authors who were doing what he did in the way that he kind of tears down those genre expectations that you were talking about. It's like, it is about overthrowing this evil empire, but there are so many fantasy series where it's like even think of Lord of the Rings. We're going to destroy this evil kingdom and evil empire and replace it with a new one that is somehow supposed to be just and good. Mm-hmm. And he's saying, like, that doesn't work.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts. Absolutely. And yeah, it is just this cycle over and over again, it feels like, of, well, we had garbage in the past, we've got garbage now, and we'll have garbage in the future.
But I do think that that is why Dune is unique, because the series, as it progresses, it's about stopping that cycle. You know, that is what God Emperor of Dune, the later books, like, they eventually, that's what they're building to, is how to get to a better end state. Not just like they live happily ever after, but like what it is you need to do in order for you to kill God, basically. And I mean, the only things I could think to compare it to, I mean, the only peers that it really has, I mean, I haven't read everything, obviously, but I mean, of course, Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, and also Asimov's Foundation trilogy engages with this sort of conversation.
And maybe a little bit, some of the Ursula Le Guin reminds me of it in the way that she looks at how things like the nature of identity is related to power.
Oh yeah. I mean, Left Hand of Darkness is,
that's what I'm thinking.
Oh, 100% in this conversation, for sure.
Yeah. I do not feel well read enough to even chime in on this, because I'm like, well, I tend to read more one-off things than the series stuff. The biggest series I read when I was younger was all of the Eternal Champions books from Michael Moorcock, but that was pretty much Things Are Tough All Over is the, the moral of that story.
Well, it's not wrong. I think also one thing that's so nice about the Dune series is that you can read the first book and that ending is so satisfying. Like, oh, yeah. I was crying and just like, it's a perfect book and it has a perfect ending. And yes, you can imagine more things, but it's over. And even Dune Messiah, I felt kind of the same way when it was over. It was like, okay, we wrapped that up. And then I was like, I'll read Children of Dune. Why not? And I had the exact same feeling. And I think the reason why I ultimately stopped after God Emperor of Dune was because I was so happy with that. Like, that ending is the one that made me the happiest. And I was like,
happiest ending overall. I
didn't want to read. I know there's Heretics and then Chapter House and then the Brian Herbert works.
House Atreides, House Harkonnen.
Yeah, I know there's more to go, but I felt such almost like a relief and a better understanding of everything after reading the fourth book. So that's kind of where I'm at with the series.
So let me ask you, what do you think he's trying to do exactly? Like, is this just a critique of power? Is it a critique of genre tropes? The first book to me is so hard to describe and thus so hard to adapt because there's just so many moving parts and so many things going on, and you have all of these different layers, like not just the great families and the emperor, but like the Bene Gesserits at the Spacing Guild, and later on the Tlilaxu. It's a brilliant and really well thought out series of stories.
No, I mean, it's kind of how it's like, it's difficult to discuss history at times and the nature of capitalism and the rise and falls of different regimes of power. And there's so many moving parts in the world that it is a perfect reflection of that. But I don't think that it is unadaptable. I just think it's really, really hard to do.
I mean, when I describe it to people, I tend to focus more on just the Messiah story itself. But what I love about this being a Messiah story is that it is being set up by the Bene Gesserit and all of these stories, and just everything is fitting. I mean, talk about just being one of the most acerbic type of books, you know, just so nihilistic, where it's like, oh yeah, yeah, we've been expecting a Messiah, and we've been expecting it because of all of these stories that were put here. I mean, it's like somebody read Joseph Campbell and said, oh, I can do this. Let's do this across the entire universe. We'll plant all these stories everywhere. And if we get into trouble, we can always just rely on those things and get ourselves out of it. I love that so much of the first book is Jessica trying to recall, like, what's the ritual here? What do I need to do in order to, you know, send these rubes into, you know, utter submission? Because that's my job, basically.
I mean, that whole function of the first book, but I would say the first two books in particular, as a critique of religious stories as a tool of propaganda, it's like reading it as a teenager, I was like, holy shit. Mm-hmm. Like something that you feel deeply on an instinctual level because of this situation that you grow up in. To have somebody clearly state out, like, oh, yes, like these stories, they might come from folk history, but they are manipulated and they're used as tools of power and tools of government and also tools of economics.
Yeah, but the tools themselves, they are power. That is where power lies. And Paul seizes on that because he has this, you know, years of, you know, breeding and what have you, eugenics, basically.
Mm-hmm. And definitely eugenics.
And also the mind-altering power of spice, that he can see the golden path. He can see the way forward in order to use all of these tools to get to this perfect harmony. And because you don't know you know that he sees the path, but you don't quite know what the path is, so you never trust him. And you're not supposed to trust him, because he is using these tools of coercion and power. He is not to be trusted. And he, Paul ultimately cannot go through with it. It's his progeny. It's his kids who later take up the mantle and go the distance and become the ultimate evil, the ultimate power over everyone, the god emperor, the worm god they become.
Spoilers.
Yeah. Right. Worm god. It's fucking nuts, man. It's like,
it's not you, Marty. It's your kids.
What are you talking about? What happens to us in the future? What, we become assholes or something?
No, Marty. Both you and Jennifer turn out fine. It's your kids, Marty. Something has got to be done about your kids.
but like, ultimately, what the worm god is trying to do is give the people the tools to kill him, to overthrow him, and recreate a society that is just, that understands what the power is that they wield and how to wield it equitably. It's ultimately tragic and triumphant. It's beautiful and disgusting. It's amazing. We fucking love
it. But I feel like that also is an important part of the, even just if you're not, you know, moving beyond the first book, it's like he is using these Bene Gesserit tools, like the Prana Bindu physical training and the fight training that comes from his family. But when you think about the bigger picture, it's more complicated than that, because the reason that he is who he is because of an act of love. Mm-hmm. Because his mother basically said, fuck what I'm supposed to do. I really love this guy and he needs a son. So I'm going to make a choice and throw a little chaos into, mm-hmm. into the mix.
Yeah. And it's that unexplainable X factor that is what changes history. And in a series that's all about prescience and knowing what happens next, it's when you do throw in the unknown really is what drives everything.
A beginning is a very delicate time. Know then that it is the year 10,191. The known universe is ruled by the Padishah Emperor Shaddam IV, my father. In this time, the most precious substance in the universe is the spice melange. The spice extends life. The spice expands consciousness. The spice is vital to space travel. The Spacing Guild and its navigators, who the spice has mutated over 4,000 years, use the orange spice gas, which gives them the ability to fold space. That is, travel to any part of the universe without moving. Oh yes, I forgot to tell you. The spice exists on only one planet in the entire universe. A desolate, dry planet with vast deserts. Hidden away within the rocks of these deserts are a people known as the Fremen, who have long held a prophecy that a man would come, a messiah, who would lead them to true freedom. The planet is Arrakis, also known as Dune.
Yeah, I still think it's such a shame that we didn't get to see Jodorowsky's adaptation. Oh, yeah. Because I feel like so much of his other work has to do with that kind of using these occult stories and symbols and rituals to become more than human, or to become more than the sort of origins of what yourself is, and those sorts of messiah stories. It's just, I think, to me, as much as I love some of the things that we're going to be talking about a little bit later in the episode, to me it is still kind of unadaptable, or at least no one has done a perfect adaptation. But if I could get into a time machine, I really would like to see his.
Oh boy, yeah. Just looking at that book of all the drawings and everything, the Book of Dune, that's one of those great, great, great what-ifs if that thing had come together. And if it ended up being 10 hours, I'm here for it all. And what they would do now, obviously, is they'd split it into three movies and we'd have the whole trilogy here.
But I think to Charles's point about the bigger philosophical underpinnings of the book, I guess the reason my brain jumped immediately to him is because he does those sorts of more esoteric philosophical narratives so well, and he does them in a way that feel also appropriately mystical. Mm-hmm. Like, as much as the book is a critique of things like power and religion and propaganda, and certainly eugenics, I think it also does feel really spiritual and mystical in a way that, you know, like Charles said at the end, it kind of makes you cry. Even if you've read it multiple times, it's just like, I don't understand how he could write a book so good that I could read it 10 times and still just be awed by the ending every time.
I want to read it again right now.
I know, dude, I'm sorry.
I've already read it this year and I want to read it again. But what you guys are discussing right now, it's making me think about a critique that I have of the Lynch film, which is kind of very surprising to me that I have this critique, because it's not the kind of critique that I think anyone has ever levied at David Lynch. I think one of the biggest problems with his adaptation is how literal it is. I mean, he's someone who you think of as the surrealist. He's someone who does engage with the esoteric. I mean, there's a fucking word named after it for him, you know, Lynchian. And the Dune film, it felt like such a literal reading of things. Like, the characters are, when they're engaging in the exposition of moving the plot along, I don't feel that spiritual stirring of some deeper force that I literally feel when I watch every single other Lynch film. And I kind of wonder why that is.
Okay, this is blowing my mind a little bit, because while I do think that Lynch is certainly surreal and uses absurdist filmmaking in amazing ways, I've never found him to be a spiritual or mystical filmmaker. I think he deals with very grounded social problems, but approaches them from an abstract, kind of dreamy way.
You're right. Yeah, the eye of the dreamer, for sure.
But it's like, unlike someone like Jodorowsky, or someone like Carl Dreyer, to go back to a much earlier filmmaker who had a big influence on both of them, I think I would maybe agree with you that while I actually really do love the Lynch Dune adaptation, as I know Mike does, I do think it doesn't feel spiritual, because none of his films do.
Okay, I actually kind of retract that bit, and I 100% I do agree with you that I am mistaking his dreamlike wonder for spirituality, which I do agree isn't the context of his films. But Mike, I know that you're the David Lynch Dune defender of the earth. You are, man. I want to just kind of ask you, what do you like about it? What do you love about it?
Oh, gosh.
Like, what is it that...
The pugs? Is it the pugs?
It's especially War Pug. War Pug's my favorite.
Long live Duke Leto!
Yeah, that's fantastic when the pug yells that, or it might be Patrick Stewart, I'm not sure. What do I love about it? I love everything about it. I love the internal voice. It is such an interesting way of going about giving us those character thoughts, and then also, kind of to your point, it's very sticking with what the book is doing. I mean, we're giving our characters an internal monologue. There's not too many films that have that and stick with it through the entire thing so well. Yeah, I love the way it looks, the way it sounds, everything about it. There's really not one particular thing where I'm just like, oh, this is the core of it, because it just all comes together as a piece.
Okay, well, I guess alternatively to scratch my critical itch, is there an aspect of the Dune film, Lynch's Dune, that leaves you wanting? Or is there a critique that you have of it that goes beyond kind of studio interference or you know, because most people don't like it. Most people have been talking shit. I avoided it for so long because I only ever heard Lynch Dune bad.
Mm-hmm.
I'll watch it after I read the books and go
Which
on the worm ride.
Which to me is so crazy.
Is there a critique that you have of it?
Some of the special effects are a little wobbly. Paul, when he's being taken up the side of the worm, where it's obvious blue screen type of stuff, that could be better. But then there's a quaintness to it as well, because you can see the effects in action. I mean, especially now, 40 years later, 40? Yeah, 40 years later, where you're just like, oh yeah, this is a practical effect. They're trying their best. It didn't work necessarily, but so many others work so well. And especially the idea of having like that Lynchian touch to things, like seeing Aaliyah in the womb or some of those great hand shots that he's doing, the whole sleeper must awake. And anytime Paul goes into some sort of spice-induced state, I just love how we just go right down to Lynchtown. And then the sound effects, the use of sound in his movies is always wonderful for me. And just that there are little musical flourishes that come up. I mean, the score, of course, is fantastic, but just those little musical and non-musical sound effects that will cue us into things. Like when I did the thing with the hand, I just think of that like high-pitched screechy noise that comes up on the soundtrack a few times. It's like, yeah, this really works for me. So I know you're asking what didn't work, and I went right back into what works.
No, I love it.
This is part of the weirding way that we will teach you. Some thoughts have a certain sound, that being the equivalent to a form. Through sound and motion, you will be able to paralyze nerves, shatter bones, set fires, suffocate an enemy or burst his organs. We will kill until no Harkonnen breathes Arrakeen air.
Yeah, that is something that I do really admire about the Lynch film and love about it as well, is when you can see Lynch in it.
Oh, yeah.
And
same.
When he's cooking, when he's vibing, when he's walking through the fucking raindrops. I mean, the scenes where, like, when the hand in the box.
Oh, yeah.
It's so good.
And the pugs. I know we set it up as, like, a silly joke to laugh at, but, like, that is a pure Lynchian aesthetic.
Yeah. Wasn't in the books.
I mean.
There were no talk of the Emperor's mini pugs, the Atreides' mini pugs, the pugs going on the big space liner as they're getting ready to fold space.
It makes sense, though, because if you think about the way that he adds idiosyncrasies into his films, mm-hmm. that is so beloved.
Oh, yeah.
If you think about just like contemporary cultural depictions of aristocracy and royalty going back literally 1,000 years, there is this real intentional cultivation of dog breeds.
And, oh, yeah. I fucking thought about that.
It totally fits with the whole eugenics thing. It's the eugenics thing again. You're right.
It totally is. It's a status symbol, a class symbol. It says, mm-hmm. you know, I have enough wealth to live this life of leisure where half of my day is spent looking after these dogs that like can't breathe properly through their nostrils because of how they've been interbred.
100%.
It makes perfect sense to me. But also the Spacing Guild, the fact that he makes an effort to introduce those larger world, very weird elements from the novel that often get left out of other adaptations because they're so bizarre.
Oh, yeah. I love that the first time we see that Spacing Guild guy just looks like a normalish bald guy with the big crazy body bag coat that they're all wearing. And then the second time you see him, he's got all those fucking tubes going in there and just all the yellow goop coming out. He's got yellow goop coming out of his nose and stuff. You're like, okay, this guy's having an experience, but you know that he's he's evolving again with the eugenic stuff. He's evolving as he goes through. And one of the great tragedies is that we see guys with like black all over their faces. I think those are supposed to be second stage guild navigators. And one of the shames of not seeing his full vision is that we don't get to see that interim between the first stage and the third stage and get that creepy looking second stage guild navigator.
Yeah, you guys are absolutely right. I mean, what you said about the pug, Sam, I can't believe that I missed that. I mean, like, what are pugs but just like
an abomination,
a mistake of man, you know, a crime. But also, with David Lynch's Dune, there's one thing that you could never ever critique about it. You could never say that he was afraid of the source material, that he was afraid of the psychedelic and the weird. He's bold, and you need to be bold to attempt
extremely bold.
Oh yeah,
to adapt Dune. Yeah, like you have to imbibe the words. Fear is the mind killer, and he clearly spoke those words before making the film.
I must not fear. Fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death that brings total obliteration. I will face my fear. I'm permitted to pass over me and through me. I must not
feel flesh.
I feel a crispy death that brings total obliteration.
Okay. I have a question for both of you that I think is something that will also come up a little bit later in this episode that I've been thinking about a lot, which is, you know, obviously, as we've been saying, as everyone who ever listens to movie podcasts knows, that David Lynch is known for the weird and the surreal and all of that. And he does get so many things right by not being afraid to lean into that weirdness. Mm-hmm. But how much do you think that the movie was hampered, and really any mainstream Hollywood adaptations would be hampered, because of the release of Star Wars and also because of how the film is pretty communist, for lack of a better word?
Well, I mean, I think that Star Wars is just, it's Dune for babies. It takes so many aspects, you know, the hero's journey of someone who is living on a desert planet. Luke is a moisture farmer. In Return of the Jedi, Jabba the Hutt is a man fused with a worm, and that movie came out 2 years after God Emperor of Dune. It's so much like the Force. What is the Force but the voice? And who are the Bene Gesserit but the Jedi? I mean, George Lucas took every concept in Dune and just drowned it in water. Like, I mean, I like Star Wars, okay? I'm talking shit because that's what I do.
Yeah, the Emperor's cool as hell.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. Yeah, I mean, I like it. It's fine. But it's just...
No, but I know what you mean about when you said that it's Dune for babies, because it does take that... I think it was Mike earlier who mentioned, or maybe it was you, mentioned that sort of Joseph Campbell power of myth, very basic storytelling structure, and where Frank Herbert takes that structure about the hero's journey and totally turns it into this whole radical critique of power. Star Wars, it's just a literal interpretation of the hero's journey, but you're in space and there are swords made out of lasers.
You're right.
And so it's like, it's for babies in the sense that it's as basic as you can get without having any of those larger power critiques, because they're just, like I said earlier, they're swapping one empire for another. They're getting rid of the wrong empire and replacing it with the right one, which is very much a for babies way of looking at fantasy and science fiction. No, I'm sorry. I just offended a lot of our listeners.
No, fuck them.
And I almost think that's why the sequel trilogy got into such problems, is because it was the bad people were back. And we're like, what? They can't do that. The bad people can't come back. They can't threaten power. Yes. Yes, they can. That's how it works.
That's how power works.
Exactly.
All right. I want to be taboo and break from what we usually do on the show and talk about, I think everybody's worm-pilled right now. Everyone has seen the new Denis Villeneuve films. Did I say that name right? How'd I do?
Mm-hmm. Worked for
you
me.
You did great.
Oh, great. Sorry. Great. Oh, I feel good.
I thought you were going to talk about the popcorn bucket.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Definitely the best piece of viral marketing in a while. Real quick, the classic, you know, hole in the bottom of the popcorn, you know, that old bit, they just flipped it around, put it on top. It's amazing. I love it.
They were like, what if we took a sandworm and combined it with a hole in the bottom popcorn bucket and a vagina in a can?
Let's go.
Let's go.
And your greasy fleshlight.
Yep. Buttery, delicious fleshlight.
Butter flavored, anyway, yeah.
Let's fucking go.
You can't say that it's actual butter on your popcorn. Be careful.
I think that the new Villeneuve movies, they fall into the same trappings that Star Wars does. I think he's afraid of the source material. I truly do. I mean, there's a lot that they get right, and I do want to expound upon that I don't just hate them. I think that he does a lot of things right, but ultimately he's afraid of being complicated. That the only real thing that he is attracted to is that, like, yes, power bad. You know, he recognizes that in it. But there's so much more that Dune is than just a critique of power. It's so much bigger than that. And I almost think that, like, watching these movies at the end of the second one, I felt like I just got out of a Marvel movie. I mean, one that was, you know, much prettier and had a better score, for sure, and actors who I had my trust in, but it was a Marvel movie. It was a Marvel movie, folks.
Thank you for admitting that.
Yeah, I didn't think so after the first movie. My initial thought was, okay, he didn't show, you know, the guild navigators. There was nothing that was really, really hard to digest in it. But he needs to get everybody in the door. He needs to get the mass audiences in the door and feeling it. He needs to get everybody vibing to his frequency. So that way, a lot of the weird stuff comes in the back half anyway.
Yeah.
And that way he can fold those things in to an already receptive audience. I just don't think that he even tried to. He didn't try.
Yeah, I thought the first movie was fine. I thought it looked good. I was entertained by it. I didn't love all the casting, but I was like, okay, I'm not mad at this and I'm willing to see where it goes. But then the second half, I have no words.
How do you feel, Mike? How do you feel?
Yeah, I agree with you that the first half was very safe and just was pretty straightforward with stuff. It had very little, for lack of a better term, magic. You know, the Bene Gesserit stuff was very low, just a little bit of the voice, that kind of stuff. And then, yeah, the second half, I mean, I just rewatched it again for this the other day, and yeah, it just, he really plays heavily into the religious zealotry, really makes Lady Jessica the villain of the piece.
Oh, absolutely.
And
she's a villain.
A totally different character than the book.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, but really the treatment of women in the second movie is just bizarro. I mean, I can understand things like, you know, you can go ahead and flip the gender of, like, Liet Kynes and those kind of things. But, like, not even having Count Fenrig, but you have his wife there in order to collect the bloodline from Fade Rautha. It was just odd. And then Fade Rautha, I mean, of course, yeah, he's supposed to be a horrible, horrible person. But the way that he kills his female servants, it so reminded me of Jared Leto when he murders the woman in Blade Runner 2049. And I'm like, what is this? I mean, it was almost the exact same setup with that.
So I was actually wondering, and I wanted to ask both of you, the only thing that I really liked about Villeneuve's part two was the portrayal of the Harkonnens, even though he insists on pronouncing their name wrong. but I thought that all that design was great, but the way that Fade kills his female servants, It seems like it's meant to ape the incredible scene where we meet Baron Harkonnen in Lynch's Dune, and he similarly is killing some of his servants, just like indiscriminately. There's blood splattering, people hitting the floor. I didn't know if that was supposed to be some kind of parallel, but because it's not his character in the book.
Right.
It kind of simplifies things, and it especially, it flattens a lot of the truly radical things that are in the books, especially the feminism.
Yeah, it's offensive. It's a downright offensive.
I think it's because he doesn't agree with the strain of feminism that Herbert is working towards. Like, Chani is just kind of, she's like a Gen Z. She's the voice of Gen Z in this. She is so not herself from the books.
She's not the character.
She's constantly storming away from the dinner table in anger, like a petulant child. And there are moments that could have been done to show her come to a deeper understanding of things that are in the book. Like, Jessica's character as a concubine to Leto, never married, and Chani, in the end, when she is now going to be forced into the role of concubine. I mean, the last passage of the book, if you guys don't mind, I kind of want to read the very last sentence of the book that I think if the movie had put in there would have completely, like, you can have Jessica as the villain, but the way that she comes to a certain deeper understanding with Chani in the end is, it's just lacking here. I'm going to pull it. I'm pulling this.
Yeah, there was such tension between those two characters all throughout the book. She was like, I don't think that this person's right for my Paul. This isn't good.
Yeah, this is a distraction.
Oh, yeah. And she was so afraid that Paul would marry her. And then once Chani helps revive him, Jessica softens to her and is like, you know what? You can marry whoever you want. You go right ahead.
And their relationship is an amazing one.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, here, I'm going to read a very brief bit here. Do you know so little of my son? Jessica whispered. See that princess standing there, so haughty and confident? They say she has pretensions of a literary nature. Let us hope she finds solace in such things. She'll have little else. A bitter laugh escaped Jessica. Think on it, Chani. That princess will have the name, yet she'll live as less than a concubine, never to know a moment of tenderness from the man to whom she's bound. While we, Chani, we who carry the name of concubine, history will call us wives. And I understand that, like, people might read that and say, like, oh, women are just wives, and kind of misinterpret what it's truly getting across, the actual, like, deeper meaning
this is part of what pissed me off so much about the rewrite of all the female characters in the second Villeneuve movie is, I to me, the way that the relationships between Jessica and Leto and Chani and Paul play out in the books, it's like he's adding another critique, which is the critique of marriage as an economic tool, as a business tool. And you have these characters who very clearly are making decisions out of love and having relationships based on strong love, emotional rapport. And ending the book that way, to me, says there's this recognition from Herbert and from these characters that marriage is just a business arrangement. It's something that you're making for convenience. It doesn't have anything to do with feelings. And love, especially love that creates a family and knits a community together. That's what's really important, and that's what history will remember. And to me, that's what that line means.
I don't like sand. It's coarse and rough and irritating, and it gets everywhere. Not like here. Here everything is soft and smooth.
That line is about love, and it's what then bonds Chani and Jessica. And to have the movie end with Chani storming away from the dinner table again,
not, so stupid.
Not having any arc. And I think that the greatest mistake of this adaptation is to take away that in the second half of Dune, there's a 4-year time jump.
Not in this movie.
No, not at all.
It's the longest 9 months of my life.
Yes.
100%. It makes Paul and Chani's romance feel like the fucking summer fling in Greece.
True.
Like these are just fucking kids who don't know any better. And it doesn't make them into like fully formed individuals with, you know, dynamic relationship patterns.
But also, the two, for me, really important things about their love is it's also a spiritual love. So it's like, yes, they're having sex and they're attracted to each other, but at its foundation, why him marrying some dumb princess? And I actually do like Irulan's character in the later books, but why that doesn't matter is because they have this really deep, enduring spiritual connection that the book really stresses. And I think one of the big things that he's doing with the book is critiquing the kind of individualism that leads to things like messianic religions and, you know, prioritizing things like big business and individual rich people. Paul is this unique individual, but he needs Chani to ground him to this community. Yeah.
She is what maintains his humanity. She is.
Yes.
They are so important to each other for that reason. So I think that the biggest one of the, I mean, there are a lot of things that I have come to accept about Villeneuve's adaptation. Like some of the things that he was afraid to adapt, like especially Alia's character, I kind of get it. Showing a four
lazy.
It is, but I mean I understand he was afraid of showing a 4-year-old speaking eloquently. Lynch certainly wasn't. Mm-mm. But the thing that he was afraid of, the thing that makes me want to brand him a coward is this fear that he had of one of the most important scenes in the book is when Paul first enters the siege, and when they have this moment of celebration, basically, when everyone engages in ritual together, the ritual of taking spice. Someone converts some, you know, water of life into something that we can all kind of drink on a little bit, and everyone gets a little fucked up, and it's basically like an orgy. It's this communal celebration. And I think the main reason why that wasn't here is because Villeneuve recognizes that depicting the pleasure of the other, you know, the capital O other, is repulsive to people, that people are repelled by that. There is this matter-antimatter crashing together when you see someone who is so different from you in enjoyment. But that is, it's just so wrong. The fact that Paul and Jessica can engage in that and become part of the Fremen community through it, it's what de-otherizes people. And he just completely, he keeps them as the other the whole time. He never breaks through that esoteric barrier. He was afraid, I think. I think he was afraid of how complicated and difficult that is. And like we keep saying, you have to be bold and fearless in order to adapt this work. And if at your heart you are not those things, you're not doing it. You're doing something else. You're making a Marvel movie.
That scene in the book is so important because that's when they shed some of their social conventions that they brought with them from Caladan. Mm. And when they really become part of this community on Arrakis. But I think part of what bugged me about the second half film adaptation is without including some of those scenes and showing Paula and Jessica as being like part of the fabric of daily life, it does sort of what you were saying and keeps them in this sort of othered state.
Yeah.
But it's like when you think about the ways that they rewrite like Stilgar's character, Stilgar is extremely heroic in the book. And in the second half of the movie, he's basically this religious zealot who refuses to see reason and makes all these jokes. And he's turned into this kind of buffoonish character in a way that I felt like was maybe a little bit racist.
Yeah, he's the comic relief.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everything he sees is just like, ooh, Lisan al-Ghaib.
Yeah.
It's so gross.
Yeah. It is. I mean, like, I laughed. Yeah, I did. And then later thinking about it, it's just, it was rude. It absolutely was.
I mean, you have to blame him because as an actor, he's just so handsome and charismatic that like, it's hard to not like him when you see him. Mm-hmm. But if you could think about like what they're doing to the character, it's like, this is repulsive. You're taking these people who have been subjugated for centuries by anyone they come across off planet. And you're turning them into this group of like religious extremists who are too dumb to consider that maybe some of these symbols were planted. And in the book, Stilgar knows that some of those stories are planted.
Exactly. And they even make it worse that the northern Fremen are a little bit more intelligent and not as religious as the southern Fremen, and that she goes south, Jessica goes south in order to capitalize on the southern Fremen and their believability in this, basically their nativity around this stuff that, okay, great, we can get these millions because I've never, you know, they always talk like how many Fremen are there? And in this, I think they say like 200 million or 2 million Fremen or something. I'm like, this is wild. And they still never made that connection in this movie that Seleucus Secundus and Arrakis are so similar and breed basically these warriors because of the difficult conditions. And yeah, you don't really get that whole idea of the importance of water when it comes to the second half of the movie. It just feels like, oh, we got dead Fremen, or not dead Fremen, we got dead Harkonnens everywhere. We can just stick these little sucker bottles on them and we got
turn them into a juice box.
Yeah, exactly. And which I just saw in Tank Girl recently, that whole bottle where it sucks the water out.
Okay. I have to ask, is there anything about the Villeneuve movies that you both liked?
Oh, yeah.
Since so far we've only talked about everything that's wrong with them.
It's so funny. I like, in my notes for the show, I like deliberately said, start off by talking about what you like, you know, I just got a little worked
up
ahead of myself.
We just got distracted.
Yeah. Well, first I want to congratulate Villeneuve on one of the directorial choices that he's made in this, and not just in this, but in all of his work. I think he has this sort of God's eye view of things that makes the scope just feel so big and so just larger than life. And I can only think of, I mean, there's plenty of directors who have done this, but like the two that come to mind most is, for example, Ridley Scott with Prometheus. He had this sort of directorial style. And also, of course, Leni Riefenstahl with Triumph of the Will. They both know how to frame things to inspire awe and terror that he is amongst them in that way. I think he would be just an incredible director of photography. I really do.
I'm kind of offended that you just compared him to Leni Riefenstahl, who is a much better director, if has far worse politics.
Yeah, well, their politics might be a little more in line than you think.
That's fair. That's definitely fair.
I think I was definitely a little tongue-in-cheek with that, but I do think that, like, I mean, Prometheus is one of those movies that, like, I don't like it. But I almost like Dune or Dune Part 2. I saw Prometheus in theaters 3 times and I didn't like it any of the 3 times.
Why?
Yeah. Why would you do that to yourself?
Guys, yes. I'm a little pain pig. I want to be hurt. And, whew. And there is something that is entrancing about that God eye view. I mean, and Leni Riefenstahl directing it towards the Nazi party and to Adolf Hitler, she successfully entranced people to it. And I think that it is, you know, a compliment and also a critique.
When is a gift, not a gift?
That it's like using these visual forms of rhetoric in order to advance something. And it's like, what is it that you're advancing? With Prometheus, it's a muddled vision. With Leni Riefenstahl, it's fascism. And with Dune, I don't know what it is yet. I'm not sure what it is he's trying to do.
Okay, so I don't know if I would totally agree that what she's advancing is fascism. I think as a filmmaker, she definitely has this way of using that God's eye view that you're talking about to evoke this kind of mystical experience.
Yes.
Which I think was important to bring up because we're talking about Dune. And she does this very interesting thing that works especially well for fascist propaganda, which is to mystify something, to ritualize it, and to make it appear more than human.
Yes.
And that's why I think some of the films that she made that aren't just propaganda have a similar quality. I don't know that I agree that that's at all what's going on in Prometheus, but I hated it so much that it's possible that I just can't see it in a critical way. But I think with something like Dune, if you could fold time and space and have Leni Riefenstahl do a Dune adaptation, it would be pretty interesting. And certainly she would be able to capture that kind of mystical quality that he utterly fails to capture in either of these two films. And I'm sorry, I asked, what did we like about
them? I don't know if he fails to capture it exactly, but I think the combination of his God's eye view and that Hans Zimmer score, like there were times where I felt moved. I felt like he was talking about...
Because of the bass. Because the bass is vibrating your seat.
I did feel the call of jihad, even though the movie never said it. Another thing the movie was afraid to do was to use the words of... To say jihad.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
To, like, imply that it might be good, you know? That maybe the universe needs a little jihad. I mean, like...
A little
that,
cleansing?
That evil pull. It wasn't exactly there, and I might have just been projecting it on there, but there's just so much that's complicated that I don't know what I am bringing myself to the table or not, but that Hans Zimmer score does work.
The Toto score is better.
I have to tell you both a really funny, strange story. So about a week ago, I got a random last-minute invite to go see a private talk that Hans Zimmer was giving.
Oh, wow.
And so the talk was meant to kind of launch to the press the fact that he's going on tour. And he had with him two musicians, the lady who does the main vocals for his Dune score, and this lady named Tina, who is like his head electric celloist that he's been working with on scores for, I think, decades now. And I'm not a big Hans Zimmer fan, mostly because I don't like a lot of the movies he's scored. Like, I think his scores are fine, but he was so humble and charming and funny that now I can't help it, but I guess I like Hans Zimmer.
Nice.
And his live shows look absolutely insane. Like for Inception, when they play parts of the Inception score, he apparently has a giant top that spins on stage.
Wow.
Yo, so I hate to put you guys on the spot, but can either of you do your best impersonation of the Dune score? You got your
Absolutely not.
Da, 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 da.
Not that score.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
The real Dune score, you mean?
No, the lady. She was with Hans Zimmer on stage. That like the lady that does that voice. That like,
yeah,
which it sounds like a Muslim call to prayer, and I think it's it's very appropriate.
Oh yeah, that part is great, and she talked about.
Yeah.
Yes, you got to get a little higher there.
it's almost the opening of Survivor.
Well, she talked about how she had to record it during the pandemic in a closet in her house because like she couldn't, I think this was like early 2020.
Whoa.
So she couldn't go anywhere.
Wait, wow. wait, you mean
that part? Puppy, yeah. She's in her closet.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. She has that in a closet. I feel like,
wow.
You
that's
know,
what she said.
To be honest, that's kind of where we record most of our Death Nerve episodes. So that's, that's nice. Wow. That's an interesting factoid.
But wait. I never got an answer to my question from Mike.
What's
is
that?
Is there anything that you like about the new Dune movies?
Oh, I think it looks beautiful. I think so much of it is gorgeous, just sumptuous to the eye. I like what he was doing with the infrared technology with the Giedi Prime. I thought that was really nice. Yeah, I thought it looked great. I did like the score on its own, but yeah, otherwise there wasn't a ton that I really cared for. I mean, it's not one that I'm going to go back to.
You're not going to see it three times in the theater like Charles?
No. I mean, I go see every time they show the Lynch Dune at the theater, I go see it. And then I'm always disappointed because I'm used to the longer versions now. But it's so wonderful to see on the big screen.
You know, I liked the Timothée Chalamet kid. I thought he was a really good Paul. And I think he looks like how I would envision him as, you know, Muad'Dib, the desert mouse. The kid looks like a goddamn mouse, you know? He and the one scene that has moved me every time I watch the movie is when he wakes up from his spice trance after drinking the water of life, and he starts using the voice to a mass of people. Mm. And he is like really coming into his own. And Jessica even says like, pull back, you know, reel it in a little bit.
Slow down.
And he isn't. He's going all in. I thought that was very evocative of Paul's kind of rise in the books and his transformation into the messianic figure. And this the feeling when he is ascending the throne in the books that I do think is a bit lost in the film is this sense of utter dread when he is ascending the throne, it is not triumphant, it is dreadful. And like he loses every friend in that ascension because they all become followers now, and there is this certain loss that I think doesn't work because they were sort of followers off the jump, it seems. Like they kind of missed that mark a little bit.
Well, also he says, if I take this path, I have to kill millions of people.
Right.
Which the movie adaptations, I don't think any movie adaptation really makes it clear what kind of sacrifice he's accepting.
Mm-hmm. No, I don't think so.
Although, if Kyle MacLachlan wanted to murder me, I'd be fine with that.
Let him. All right. Well, this was kind of fun. I feel like, honestly, we could probably talk about this shit forever.
But
this has been very nice. I obviously had a lot of shit I needed to get off my chest. I recently I stopped using Letterboxd. I think it's been like, you know, breaking my brain a little bit to like feel like, oh, this movie's worth 3.5 stars, but let's see if we can reevaluate it later. And I'm just like constantly judging movies in this way that I never have before. So I'm retiring from Letterboxd for that reason. But after seeing Dune, I just kind of, I was like scouring the internet, like looking to be seen or to recognize what I was feeling. And I kind of didn't really get it anywhere. It seems like everyone seems to just love it so much. And I think that might be also why I saw it 3 times, because
you want to understand.
Yes. I want to love, I want to feel those things, especially when it comes to like what the zeitgeist is and what this, like the shiny new objects that people are attracted to. And I want to not lose that thread on things. So I guess this was a, you know, it was a very cathartic conversation for that reason.
Yeah, I knew that if we were going to do a Dune episode and Mike had time, he, of course, had to be our guest. Because which version did you do the commentary on?
It was the theatrical version, yeah.
Okay, that's what I thought.
Yeah.
I have trouble keeping them straight because it's like I'll watch Lynch's Dune every couple of years and I feel like I wind up watching a different version mm-hmm. each time, so they like clash in my head, or they've melded in my head.
Oh yeah.
Do you prefer the unofficial Alan Smitty director's cut, or do you prefer one of the fan edits, the Spice Diver?
I definitely prefer Spice Diver over the Smithy version. I mean, Spice Diver, the Smithy version obviously gives us a lot more things, but that Spice Diver puts things in the correct order, also fixes the eyes and then adds even more to it. It just feels like a more complete movie. And then to find out that there are even more things that aren't part of the Spice Diver edit, that there are still missing scenes. They just unearthed a scene with Hera, Lady Jessica, and Aaliyah. And you can hear Alicia Witt's real voice in that part. I think there's one other thing inside of the Spice Diver edit that has Aaliyah's real voice, that has Alicia Witt there. But there's still more stuff, and I've read about other things, I've seen stills from things, so there's still more. I wish that we could get a fuller version of it, if anything.
I got a feeling over time we will. There are dogged editors out there who feel the kind of love that we feel too, who will. It's always going to keep getting tinkered with, which is kind of nice mm-hmm. because it was something that, like, even when you watch the Lynch film, you know there's so much more under the surface that we'll get it someday. I'm sure. I'm certain of it.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah. It's funny because I tend to get super annoyed by directors who constantly tinker with their films. Like, Ridley Scott is a big thorn in my side because of that. But with something like the Lynch Dune, I think because it wasn't the version he wanted it to be, and it was just this huge unwieldy thing from the studio's perspective, like, this is a sort of thing where it's like every couple of years, give us a new scene.
Right. Yeah. And it's not even him doing it, which is crazy. You know?
Yes.
I mean, he wants nothing to do with this anymore.
Yeah. I don't blame him. I don't blame him. What's going on in Mike White world? How's the projection booth going? You got any new fun episodes on the docket?
Always have a new fun episode. This week we are wrapping up it's just kind of a grab bag month, doing an episode though about Communion. So I'm very excited.
Oh, the Christopher Walken movie?
Yes.
Oh,
cool. Yes.
Oh, hell yeah.
Got interviews with the director, Philippe Mora, and then also the author and the guy who's being portrayed by Christopher Walken, Whitley Strieber. So that's a pretty fun conversation.
Oh, wow.
How do you do it, man? How do you do it?
Well, Whitley's been on the show a few times, so that was nice. And then Philippe was very generous with his time. So talked to him about some of the Howling movies and whatnot. So that was pretty fun, too.
Wow. I can't wait for that.
Wait, and April is Japan month?
Yeah, April is Japanese month, and we've got Ms. Sam Deegan on, 2 episodes for that, between the first one, R100, and then the last one where we talk about Shura, or Demons.
Hell yes.
A lot of fun.
I would honestly, if we're still folding time and space, there are definitely some of those Japanese directors from the new wave, like Teshi Gahara, who I would love to see do a Dune adaptation.
Oh, but
like not
God.
Just because yeah. he's great at filming, like Woman in the Dunes is so beautiful, but that like kind of eerie existential dread but spiritual wonder that some of those directors capture. It's just anywhere but Hollywood. Give me the next adaptation somewhere else.
Give them each a planet. You know, you give Aoshima one, Teshi Gahara yes. one, Matsumoto one. I don't know. Maybe Oshima one. I mean, it'd be great. Each one has something different. And yeah, you could have the director of Woman in the Dunes doing the Arrakis stuff. That'd be fantastic.
Oh, man.
And
this is so nice.
You could have Yukio Mishima directing anything involving the Harkonnen.
Oh, he could be the God Emperor himself.
Oh, he could.
Hell yeah.
I wish that we could see this magical Japanese New Wave mashup version. It'd be like one of those 80s supergroups, except instead of Ted Nugent, it's...
right. Half produced by ATG. Yeah, it'd be great.
Oh, man, this was really fun to do because last week we did our solo episode. And honestly, that really took a toll on me. I that might be why I watched Dune 3 times, honestly. Like, to just kind of clear my brain a little bit.
I mean, they're both critiques of power with true. Sexual sadism.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those guys are pretty much Harkonnens.
Yeah.
They are. Yeah. I could definitely see a parallel there.
I could see Baron Harkonnen. Manja!
Yeah. Yeah. All right. This has been an absolute ball. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Mike White. This has been so good.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate this. Yeah.
Come back anytime.
Will do.
Yes, please.
All right. So long, everybody.
Bye.